Last time for Henrik. Don't say that, Dirk. What do you mean?
I've found new evidence, Blomqvist said. I told Henrik about some of it yesterday. I'm very much afraid that it may have helped to bring on his heart attack.
Frodo looked at him with a strange expression.
You're joking.
You must be.
Blomqvist shook his head.
Over the past few days, I found significant material about Harriet's disappearance. What I'm worried about is that we never discussed who I should report to, if Henrik is no longer here.
You report to me.
Okay. I have to go on with this. Can I put you in the picture right now?
Blomqvist described what he had found as concisely as possible, and he showed Frodo the series of pictures from Jernvegsgarten. Then he explained how his own daughter had unlocked the mystery of the names in the datebook. Finally, he proposed the connection, as he had for Wanger the day before, with the murder of Rebecca Jacobson in 1949, R.J. The only thing he kept to himself was Cecilia Wanger's face in Harriet's window. He had to talk to her before he put her in a position where she might be suspected of something. Frodo's brow was creased with concern.
You really think that the murder of Rebecca has something to do with Harriet's disappearance?
It seems unlikely, I agree, but the fact remains that Harriet wrote the initials R.J. in her datebook, next to the reference to the Old Testament law about burnt offerings. Rebecca Jacobson was burned to death. One connection with the Wanger family is inescapable. She worked for the corporation.
But what is the connection with Harriet?
I don't know yet, but I want to find out. I will tell you everything I would have told Henrik. You have to make the decisions for him.
Perhaps we ought to inform the police.
No, at least not without Henrik's blessing. The statute of limitations has long since run out in the case of Rebecca, and the police investigation was closed. They're not going to reopen an investigation 54 years later.
All right. What are you going to do?
Blomqvist paced a lap around the kitchen.
First, I want to follow up the photograph lead. If we could see what it was that Harriet saw, it might be the key. I need a car to go to Norcia and follow that lead, wherever it takes me. And also, I want to research each of the Leviticus verses. We have one connection to one murder. We have 4 verses, possibly 4 other clues. To do this, I need some help.
What kind of help?
I really need a research assistant with the patience to go through old newspaper archives to find Magda and Sarah and the other names. If I'm right in thinking that Rebecca wasn't the only victim.
You mean you want to let someone else in on...
There's a lot of work that has to be done, and in a hurry. If I were a police officer involved in an active investigation, I could divide up the hours and resources and get people to dig for me. I need a professional who knows archive work and who can be trusted.
I understand. Actually, I believe I know of an expert researcher, said Frodo.
And before he could stop himself, he added, she was the one who did the background investigation on you.
Who did what? Blomqvist said.
I was thinking out loud, Frodo said. It's nothing.
I'm getting old, he thought. You had someone do an investigation on me?
It's nothing dramatic, Mikael. We wanted to hire you, and we just did a check on what sort of person you were.
So that's why Henrik always seems to know exactly where he has me. How thorough was this investigation?
It was quite thorough.
Did it look into Millennium's problems?
Frodo shrugged.
It had a bearing.
Blomqvist lit a cigarette. It was his 5th of the day.
A written report?
Mikael, it's nothing to get worked up about.
I want to read the report, he said.
Oh, come on. There's nothing out of the ordinary about this. We wanted to check up on you before we hired you.
I want to read the report, Mikael repeated.
I couldn't authorize that.
Really? Then here's what I say to you. Either I have that report in my hands within the hour, or I quit. I'll take the evening train back to Stockholm.
Where is the report? The 2 men eyed each other for several seconds. Then Frodo sighed and looked away.
In my office, at home.
Frodo had put up a terrible fuss. It was not until 6 that evening that Blomqvist had Lisbeth Salander's report in his hand. It was almost 80 pages long, plus dozens of photocopied articles, certificates, and other records of the details of his life and career. It was a strange experience to read about himself in what was part biography and part intelligence report. He was increasingly astonished at how detailed the report was. Salander had dug up facts that he thought had been long buried in the compost of history. She had dug up his youthful relationship with a woman who had been a flaming syndicalist and who was now a politician. Who in the world had she talked to? She had found his rock band Bootstrap, which surely no one today would remember. She had scrutinized his finances down to the last aura. How the hell had she done it? As a journalist, Blomqvist had spent many years hunting down information about people, and he could judge the quality of the work from a purely professional standpoint. There was no doubt that this Salander was one hell of an investigator. He doubted that even he could have produced a comparable report on any individual completely unknown to him. It also dawned on him that there had never been any reason for him and Berger to keep their distance in Wanger's presence. He already knew of their long-standing relationship. The report came up with a disturbingly precise appraisal of Millennium's financial position. Wanger knew just how shaky things were when he first contacted Berger. What sort of game was he playing? The Wennerström affair was merely summarized, but whoever wrote the report had obviously been a spectator in court during part of the trial. The report questioned Blomqvist's refusal to comment during the trial. Smart woman. The next second, Mikhail straightened up, hardly able to believe his eyes. Salander had written a brief passage giving her assessment of what would happen after the trial. She had reproduced, virtually word for word, the press release that he and Berger had submitted after he resigned as publisher of Millennium. But Salander had used his original wording. He glanced again at the cover of the report. It was dated 3 days before Blomqvist was sentenced. That was impossible. The press release existed then in only one place in the whole world, in Blomqvist's computer, in his iBook, not on his computer at the office. The text was never printed out. Not even Berger had a copy, although they had talked about the subject. Blomqvist put down Salander's report. He put on his jacket and went out into the night, which was very bright 1 week before midsummer. He walked along the shore of the Sound, past Cecilia Wanger's property and the luxurious motorboat below Martin Wanger's villa. He walked slowly, pondering as he went. Finally he sat on a rock and looked at the flashing buoy lights in Hedestad Bay. There was only one conclusion. "You've been in my computer, Fröken Salander," he said aloud. "You're a fucking hacker." Chapter 18. Wednesday, June 18th. Salander awoke with a start from a dreamless slumber. She felt faintly sick. She did not have to turn her head to know that Mimi had left already for work, but her scent still lingered in the stuffy air of the bedroom. Salander had drunk too many beers the night before with the evil fingers at the mill. Mimi had turned up not long before closing time and come home with her and into bed. Salander, unlike Mimi, had never thought of herself as a lesbian. She had never brooded over whether she was straight, gay, or even bisexual. She did not give a damn about labels, did not see that it was anyone else's business whom she spent her nights with. If she had to choose, she preferred guys, and they were in the lead, statistically speaking. The only problem was finding a guy who was not a jerk and one who was also good in bed. Mimi was a sweet compromise, and she turned Salander on. They had met in a beer tent at the Pride Festival a year ago, and Mimi was the only person that Salander had introduced to the evil fingers. But it was still just a casual affair for both of them. It was nice lying close to Mimi's warm, soft body, and Salander did not mind waking up with her and there having breakfast together. Her clock said it was 9:30, and she was wondering what could have woken her when the doorbell rang again. She sat up in surprise. No one had ever rung her doorbell at this hour. Very few people rang her doorbell at all. She wrapped a sheet around her and walked unsteadily to the hall to open the door. She stared straight into the eyes of Mikhail Blomqvist, felt panic race through her body, and took a step back. "Good morning, Fröken Salander," he greeted her cheerfully. "It was a late night, I see. Can I come in?" Without waiting for an answer, he walked in, closing the door behind him. He regarded with curiosity the pile of clothes on the hall floor and the rampart of bags filled with newspapers. Then he peered through the bedroom door while Salander's world started spinning in the wrong direction. "How? What? Who?" Blomqvist looked at her bewilderment with amusement.
I assumed that you would not have had breakfast yet, so I brought some filled bagels with me. I got one with roast beef, one with turkey and Dijon mustard, and one vegetarian with avocado, not knowing your preference. He marched into her kitchen and started rinsing her coffee maker. "Where do you keep coffee?" he said. Salander stood in the hall as if frozen until she heard the water running out of the tap. She took three quick strides.
"Stop! Stop at once!"
She realized that she was shouting and lowered her voice.
"Damn it all! You can't come barging in here as if you owned the place. We don't even know each other."
Blomqvist paused, holding a jug, and turned to look at her. "Wrong. You know me better than almost anyone else does. Isn't that so?" He turned his back on her and poured the water into the machine, then he started opening her cupboards in search of coffee.
"Speaking of which, I know how you do it. I know your secrets."
Salander shut her eyes, wishing that the floor would stop pitching under her feet. She was in a state of mental paralysis. She was hungover. This situation was unreal, and her brain was refusing to function. Never had she met one of her subjects face to face.
"He knows where I live."
He was standing in her kitchen. This was impossible. It was outrageous.
"He knows who I am."
She felt the sheet slipping, and she pulled it tighter around her. He said something, but at first she didn't understand him.
"We have to talk," he said again. "But I think you'd better take a shower first."
She tried to speak sensibly.
"You listen to me. If you're thinking of making trouble, I'm not the one you should be talking to. I was just doing a job. You should talk to my boss."
He held up his hands. "A universal sign of peace, or I have no weapon.
I've already talked to Armansky. By the way, he wants you to ring him. You didn't answer his call last night."
She did not sense any threat, but she still stepped back a pace when he came closer, took her arm, and escorted her to the bathroom door. She disliked having anyone touch her without her leave.
"I don't want to make trouble," he said, "but I'm quite anxious to talk to you. After you're awake, that is. The coffee will be ready by the time you put on some clothes. First, a shower. Vamoose."
Passively, she obeyed.
"Lisbeth Salander is never passive," she thought.
She leaned against the bathroom door and struggled to collect her thoughts. She was more shaken than she would have thought possible. Gradually she realized that a shower was not only good advice, but a necessity after the tumult of the night. When she was done, she slipped into her bedroom and put on jeans and a T-shirt with the slogan, "Armageddon was yesterday. Today we have a serious problem." After pausing for a second, she searched through her leather jacket that was slung over a chair. She took the taser out of the pocket, checked to see that it was loaded, and stuck it in the back pocket of her jeans. The smell of coffee was spreading through the apartment. She took a deep breath and went back to the kitchen.
"Do you never clean up?" he said.
He had filled the sink with dirty dishes and ashtrays. He had put the old milk cartons into a rubbish sack and cleared the table of 5 weeks of newspapers. He had washed the table clean and put out mugs and, he wasn't joking after all, bagels.
"Okay, let's see where this is heading."
She sat down opposite him. "You didn't answer my question. Roast beef, turkey, or vegetarian?"
"Roast beef."
"Then I'll take the turkey." They ate in silence, scrutinizing each other. When she finished her bagel, she also ate half of the vegetarian one. She picked up a crumpled pack of cigarettes from the windowsill and dug one out. He broke the silence.
"I may not be as good as you at investigations, but at least I found out that you're not a vegetarian, or, as Herr Froder thought, anorexic. I'll include that information in my report."
Salander stared at him, but he looked so amused that she gave him a crooked smile. The situation was beyond all rhyme or reason. She sipped her coffee. He had kind eyes. She decided that whatever else he might be, he did not seem to be a malicious person. And there was nothing in the PI she had done that would indicate he was a vicious bastard who abused his girlfriends, or anything like that. She reminded herself that she was the one who knew everything.
"Knowledge is power." "What are you grinning at?" she said.
"I'm sorry. I'd not in fact planned to make my entrance in this way. I didn't mean to alarm you. But you should have seen your face when you opened the door. It was priceless."
Silence. To her surprise, Salander found his uninvited intrusion acceptable. Well, at least not unpleasant. "You'll have to think of it as my revenge for your poking around in my personal life," he said. "Are you frightened?"
"Not the least bit," Salander said.
"Good. I'm not here to make trouble for you."
"If you even try to hurt me, I'll have to do you an injury. You'll be sorry."
Blomqvist studied her. She was barely 4'11" and did not look as though she could put up much resistance if he were an assailant who had forced his way into her apartment, but her eyes were expressionless and calm. "Well, that won't be necessary," he said at last. "I only need to talk to you. If you want me to leave, all you have to do is say so." "It's funny, but..."
"Oh, nothing." "What?"
"This may sound crazy, but 4 days ago I didn't even know you existed. Then I read your analysis of me." He searched through his shoulder bag and brought out the report. It was not entertaining reading. He looked out of the kitchen window for a while. "Could I bum a cigarette?" She slid the pack across the table. "You said before that we don't know each other, and I said that yes, we do." He pointed at the report. "I can't compete with you. I've only done a rapid routine check to get your address and date of birth, stuff like that. But you certainly know a great deal about me, much of which is private, damn it. Things that only my closest friends know. And now here I am, sitting in your kitchen and eating bagels with you. We have known each other half an hour, but I have the feeling that we've been friends for years. Does that make sense to you?" She nodded. "You have beautiful eyes," he said.
"You have nice eyes yourself," she said.
Long silence.
"Why are you here?" she said.
Carlo Blomqvist, she remembered his nickname and suppressed the impulse to say it out loud, suddenly looked serious. He also looked very tired. The self-confidence that he had shown when he first walked into her apartment was now gone. The clowning was over, or at least had been put aside. She felt him studying her closely. Salander felt that her composure was barely skin deep, and that she really wasn't in complete control of her nerves. This totally unlooked-for visit had shaken her in a way that she had never experienced in connection with her work. Her bread and butter was spying on people. In fact, she had never thought of what she did for Armansky as a real job. She thought of it more as a complicated pastime, a sort of hobby. The truth was that she enjoyed digging into the lives of other people and exposing the secrets they were trying to hide. She had been doing it in one form or another for as long as she could remember. And she was still doing it today, not only when Armansky gave her an assignment, but sometimes for the sheer fun of it. It gave her a kick. It was like a complicated computer game, except that it dealt with real, live people. And now one of her hobbies was sitting right here in her kitchen, feeding her bagels. It was totally absurd.
"I have a fascinating problem," Blomqvist said. "Tell me this. When you were doing your research on me for Herr Froder, did you have any idea what it was going to be used for?"
"No."
The purpose was to find out all that information about me because Froder, or rather his employer, wanted to give me a freelance job.
"I see."
He gave her a faint smile.
"One of these days you and I should have a discussion about the ethics of snooping into other people's lives. But right now I have a different problem. The job I was offered, and which inexplicably I agreed to do, is, without doubt, the most bizarre assignment I've ever undertaken. Before I say more, I need to be able to trust you, Lisbeth."
"What do you mean?"
"Armansky tells me you're 100% reliable, but I still want to ask you the question. Can I tell you confidential things without your telling them to anyone else, by any means, ever?"
"Wait a minute. You've talked to Dragan? Is he the one who sent you here?"
"I'm going to kill you, you fucking stupid Armenian."
"Not exactly. You're not the only one who can find out someone's address. I did that all on my own. I looked you up in the National Registry. There are 3 Lisbeth Salanders, and the other 2 weren't a good match. But I had a long talk with Armansky yesterday. He, too, thought that I wanted to make trouble over your ferreting around in my private life. In the end, I convinced him that I had a legitimate purpose."
"Which is what?"
"As I told you, Froder's employer hired me to do a job. I've reached a point where I need a skilled researcher. Froder told me about you and said that you were pretty good. He hadn't meant to identify you, it just slipped out. I explained to Armansky what I wanted. He okayed the whole thing and tried to call you. And here I am. Call him if you want."
It took Salander a minute to find her mobile among the clothes that Mimi had pulled off her. Blomqvist watched her embarrassed search with interest as he patrolled the apartment. All her furniture seemed to be strays. She had a state-of-the-art power book on an apology for a desk in the living room. She had a CD player on a shelf. Her CD collection was a pitiful total of 10 CDs by groups he had never heard of, and the musicians on the covers looked like vampires from outer space. Music was probably not her big interest. Salander saw that Armansky had called her 7 times the night before and twice this morning. She punched in his number while Blomqvist leaned against the doorframe and listened to the conversation.
"It's me. Sorry. Yes. It was turned off. I know he wants to hire me. No, he's standing in the middle of my fucking living room, for Christ's sake."
She raised her voice.
"Dragon, I'm hungover and my head hurts, so please, no games. Did you okay this job or not?" "Thanks."
Salander looked through the door to the living room at Blomqvist pulling out CDs and taking books off the bookshelf. He had just found a brown pill bottle that was missing its label, and he was holding it up to the light. He was about to unscrew the top, so she reached out and took the bottle from him. She went back to the kitchen and sat down on a chair, massaging her forehead until he joined her.
"The rules are simple," she said. "Nothing that you discuss with me or with Armansky will be shared with anyone at all. There will be a contract which states that Milton Security pledges confidentiality. I want to know what the job is about before I decide whether I want to work for you or not. That also means that I agree to keep to myself everything you tell me, whether I take the job or not, provided that you're not conducting any sort of serious criminal activity, in which case I'll report it to Dragan, who in turn will report it to the police."
"Fine," he hesitated. "Armansky may not be completely aware of what I want to hire you for."
"Some historical research," he said.
"Well, yes, that's right. I want you to help me to identify a murderer." It took Blomqvist an hour to explain all the intricate details in the Harriet Wanger case. He left nothing out. He had Froda's permission to hire her, and to do that, he had to be able to trust her completely. He told her everything about Cecilia Wanger, and that he had found her face in Harriet's window. He gave Salander as good a description of her character as he could. She had moved high up on the list of suspects, his list, but he was still far from believing that she could be in any way associated with a murderer who was active when she was still a young woman. He gave Salander a copy of the list in the datebook: Magda 32016, Sarah 32109, RJ 30112, RL 32027, Mari 32018, and he gave her a copy of the verses from Leviticus.
"What do you want me to do?"
"I've identified the RJ, Rebecca Jacobson." He told her what the 5-figure numbers stood for. "If I'm right, then we're going to find 4 more victims. Magda, Sarah, Mari, and RL.
"You think they're all murdered?"
"What I'm thinking is that we're looking for someone who, if the other numbers and initials also prove to be shorthand for 4 more killings, is a murderer who was active in the 50s and maybe also in the 60s, and who is in some way linked to Harriet Wanger. I've gone through back issues of the Hedestad Courier. Rebecca's murder is the only grotesque crime that I could find with a connection to Hedestad. I want you to keep digging, all over Sweden if necessary, until you make sense of the other names and verses." Salander thought in expressionless silence for such a long time that Blomqvist began to grow impatient. He was wondering whether he had chosen the wrong person when she at last raised her head.
"I'll take the job. But first, you have to sign a contract with Armansky."
Armansky printed out the contract that Blomqvist would take back to Hedestad for Froda's signature. When he returned to Salander's office, he saw how she and Blomqvist were leaning over her power book. He had his hand on her shoulder.
He was touching her and pointing.
Armansky paused in the corridor. Blomqvist said something that seemed to surprise Salander. Then she laughed out loud. Armansky had never once heard her laugh before, and for years he had been trying to win her trust. Blomqvist had known her for 5 minutes, and she was practically giggling with him. He felt such a loathing for Blomqvist at that moment that he surprised himself. He cleared his throat as he stood in the doorway and put down the folder with the contract. Blomqvist paid a quick visit to the Millennium office in the afternoon. It was his first time back. It felt very odd to be running up those familiar stairs. They had not changed the code on the door, and he was able to slip in unnoticed and stand for a moment looking around. Millennium's offices were arranged in an L shape. The entry was a hall that took up a lot of space without being able to be put to much use. There were two sofas there, so it was by way of being a reception area. Beyond was a lunchroom kitchenette, then cloakroom toilets, and two storage rooms with bookshelves and filing cabinets. There was also a desk for an intern. To the right of the entry was the glass wall of Malm's studio, which took up about 400 square feet, with its own entrance from the landing. To the left was the editorial office encompassing about 350 square feet, with the windows facing Guttgarten. Berger had designed everything, putting in glass partitions to make separate quarters for three of the employees, and an open plan for the others. She had taken the largest room at the very back for herself, and given Blomqvist his own room at the opposite end. It was the only room that you could look into from the entry. No one had moved into it, it seemed. The third room was slightly apart from the others, and it was occupied by Sonny Magnusson, who had been for several years Millennium's most successful advertising salesman. Berger had hand-picked him. She offered him a modest salary and a commission. Over the past year, it had not made any difference how energetic he was as a salesman. Their advertising income had taken a beating, and Magnusson's income with it. But instead of looking elsewhere, he had tightened his belt and loyally stayed put. Unlike me, who caused the whole landslide, Blomqvist thought. He gathered his courage and walked into the office. It was almost deserted. He could see Berger at her desk, telephone pressed to her ear. Monica Nielsen was at her desk, an experienced general reporter specializing in political coverage. She could be the most jaded cynic he had ever met. She'd been at Millennium for 9 years and was thriving. Henry Cortez was the youngest employee on the editorial staff. He had come as an intern straight out of JMK 2 years ago, saying that he wanted to work at Millennium and nowhere else. Berger had no budget to hire him, but she offered him a desk in a corner, and soon took him on as a permanent dog's body, and anon as a staff reporter. Both uttered cries of delight. He received kisses on the cheek and pats on the back. At once they asked him if he was returning to work. No, he had just stopped by to say hello and have a word with the boss. Berger was glad to see him. She asked about Wanger's condition. Blomqvist knew no more than what Frode could tell him. His condition was inescapably serious. "So what are you doing in the city?" Blomqvist was embarrassed. He had been at Milton Security only a few streets away, and he had decided on sheer impulse to come in. It seemed too complicated to explain that he had been there to hire a research assistant who was a security consultant who had hacked into his computer. Instead, he shrugged and said he had to come to Stockholm on Wanger-related business, and he would have to go back north at once. He asked how things were going at the magazine.
"Apart from the good news on the advertising and the subscription fronts, there is one cloud on the horizon."
"Which is?"
"Jana Dahlman."
"Of course."
"I had a talk with him in April, after we released the news that Henrik had become a partner. I don't know if it's just Jana's nature to be negative, or if there's something more serious going on, if he's playing some sort of game."
"What happened?"
"It's nothing I can put a finger on. Rather that I no longer trust him. After we signed the agreement with Wanger, Krister and I had to decide whether to inform the whole staff that we were no longer at risk of going under this autumn, or—"
"Or to sell just a chosen few."
"Exactly. I may be paranoid, but I didn't want to risk having Dahlman leak the story, so we decided to inform the whole staff on the same day the agreement was made public, which meant that we kept the lid on it for over a month."
"And?"
"Well, that was the first piece of good news they'd had in a year. Everyone cheered except for Dahlman. I mean, we don't have the world's biggest editorial staff. There were three people cheering, plus the intern, and one person who got his nose out of joint because we hadn't told everybody earlier."
"He had a point."
"I know. But the thing is, he kept on bitching about the issue day after day, and morale in the office was affected. After 2 weeks of this shit, I called him into my office and told him to his face that my reason for not having informed the staff earlier was that I didn't trust him to keep the news secret."
"How did he take it?"
"He was terribly upset, of course. I stood my ground and gave him an ultimatum. Either he had to pull himself together or start looking for another job."
"And?"
"He pulled himself together. But he keeps to himself, and there's a tension between him and the others. Krista can't stand him, and he doesn't hide it.
What do you suspect Dahlman of doing?
I don't know. We hired him a year ago, when we were first talking about trouble with Venestrom. I can't prove a thing, but I have a nasty feeling that he's not working for us.
Trust your instincts.
Maybe he's just a square peg in a round hole who just happens to be poisoning the atmosphere.
It's possible. But I agree that we made a mistake when we hired him. Half an hour later, he was on his way north, across the locks at Slussen, in the car he had borrowed from Froda's wife. It was a 10-year-old Volvo she never used. Blomqvist had been given leave to borrow it whenever he liked. It was the tiny details that he could easily have missed if he had not been alert. Some papers not as evenly stacked as he remembered. A binder not quite flush on the shelf. His desk drawer closed all the way. He was positive that it was an inch open when he left. Someone had been inside his cottage. He had locked the door, but it was an ordinary old lock that almost anyone could pick with a screwdriver, and who knew how many keys were in circulation. He systematically searched his office, looking for what might be missing. After a while, he decided that everything was still there. Nevertheless, someone had been in the cottage and gone through his papers and binders. He had taken his computer with him, so they had not been able to access that. Two questions arose. Who was it, and how much had his visitor been able to find out? The binders belonged to the part of Wanger's collection that he brought back to the guest house after returning from prison. There was nothing of the new material in them. His notebooks in the desk would read like code to the uninitiated, but was the person who had searched his desk uninitiated? In a plastic folder on the middle of the desk, he had put a copy of the date book list and a copy of the verses. That was serious. It would tell whoever it was that the date book code was cracked. So who was it? Wanger was in the hospital. He did not suspect Anna. Froda? He'd already told him all the details. Cecilia Wanger had cancelled her trip to Florida and was back from London, along with her sister. Blomqvist had only seen her once driving her car across the bridge the day before. Martin Wanger, Harold Wanger, Birger Wanger. He had turned up for a family gathering to which Blomqvist had not been invited on the day after Wanger's heart attack. Alexander Wanger, Isabella Wanger. Whom had Froda talked to? What might he have let slip this time? How many of the anxious relatives had picked up on the fact that Blomqvist had made a breakthrough in his investigation? It was after 8. He called the locksmith in Hedestad and ordered a new lock. The locksmith said he could come out the following day. Blomqvist said he would pay double if he came at once. They agreed that he would come at around 10:30 that night and install a new deadbolt lock. Blomqvist drove to Froda's house. His wife showed him into the garden behind the house and offered him a cold pilsner, which he gratefully accepted. He asked how Henrik Wanger was. Froda shook his head. They operated on him. He had blockages in his coronary arteries. The doctors say that the next few days are critical. They thought about this for a while as they drank their pilsners. You haven't talked to him, I suppose? No. He's not well enough to talk. How did it go in Stockholm? The Salander girl accepted the job. Here's the contract from Milton Security. You have to sign it and put it in the post. Froda read through the document. She's expensive, he said. Henrik can afford it. Froda nodded. He took a pen out of his breast pocket and scrawled his name. It's a good thing that I'm signing it while he's still alive. Could you put it in the letterbox at Consum on your way home? Blomqvist was in bed by midnight, but he could not sleep. Until now his work on Hedeby Island had seemed like research on a historical curiosity, but if someone was sufficiently interested in what he was doing to break into his office, then the solution had to be closer to the present than he had thought. Then it occurred to him that there were others who might be interested in what he was working on. Wanger's sudden appearance on the board of Millennium had not gone unnoticed by Venestrom. Or was this paranoia? Mikhail got out of bed and went to stand naked at the kitchen window, gazing at the church on the other side of the bridge. He lit a cigarette. He couldn't figure out Lisbeth Salander. She was altogether odd. Long pauses in the middle of the conversation.
Her apartment was messy, bordering on chaotic. Bags filled with newspapers in the hall, a kitchen that had not been cleaned or tidied in years. Clothes were scattered in heaps on the floor. She had obviously spent half the night in a bar. She had love bites on her neck, and she had clearly had company overnight. She had heaven knows how many tattoos and 2 piercings on her face, and maybe in other places. She was weird. Armansky assured him that she was their very best researcher, and her report on him was excruciatingly thorough. A strange girl. Sarander was sitting at her power book, but she was thinking about Mikhail Blomkvist. She had never in her adult life allowed anyone to cross her threshold without an express invitation, and she could count those she had invited on one hand. Blomkvist had nonchalantly barged into her life, and she had uttered only a few lame protests. Not only that, he had teased her. Under normal circumstances, that sort of behaviour would have made her mentally cock a pistol, but she had not felt an iota of threat or any sort of hostility from his side. He had good reason to read her the riot act, even report her to the police. Instead, he had treated even her hacking into his computer as a joke. That had been the most sensitive part of their conversation. Blomkvist seemed to be deliberately not broaching the subject, and finally she could not help asking the question.
"You said that you knew what I did."
"You've been inside my computer. You're a hacker."
"How do you know that?"
Sallander was absolutely positive that she had left no traces and that her trespassing could not be discovered by anyone unless a top security consultant sat down and scanned the hard drive at the same time as she was accessing the computer.
"You made a mistake."
She had quoted from a text that was only on his computer. Sallander sat in silence. Finally, she looked up at him, her eyes expressionless.
"How did you do it?" he asked.
"My secret. What are you thinking of doing about it?"
Mikhail shrugged.
"What can I do?"
"It's exactly what you do as a journalist."
"Of course. And that's why we journalists have an ethics committee that keeps track of the moral issues. When I write an article about some bastard in the banking industry, I leave out, for instance, his or her private life. I don't say that a forger is a lesbian, or gets turned on by having sex with her dog or anything like that, even if it happens to be true. Bastards, too, have a right to their private lives. Does that make sense?"
"Yes."
"So you encroached on my integrity. My employer doesn't need to know who I have sex with. That's my business."
Salander's face was creased by a crooked smile.
"You think I shouldn't have mentioned that?"
"In my case, it didn't make a lot of difference. Half the city knows about my relationship with Erica. But it's a matter of principle."
"In that case, it might amuse you to know that I also have principles comparable to your ethics committees. I call them Sarander's principles. One of them is that a bastard is always a bastard, and if I can hurt a bastard by digging up shit about him, then he deserves it."
"Okay," Blomkvist said. "My reasoning isn't too different from yours, but..."
"But the thing is that when I do a PI, I also look at what I think about the person. I'm not neutral. If the person seems like a good sort, I might tone down my report."
"Really?"
"In your case, I toned it down. I could have written a book about your sex life. I could have mentioned to Froda that Erika Berger has a past in Club Extreme and played around with BDSM in the 80s, which would have prompted certain unavoidable notions about your sex life and hers."
Blomkvist met Salander's gaze. After a moment, he laughed.
"You're really meticulous, aren't you? Why didn't you put it in the report?"
"You are adults who obviously like each other. What you do in bed is nobody's business, and the only thing I would have achieved by talking about her was to hurt both of you, or to provide someone with blackmail material. I don't know Froda. The information could have ended up with Venestrom."
"And you don't want to provide Venestrom with information?"
"If I had to choose between you and him, I'd probably end up in your court."
"Erica and I have a... our relationship is..."
"Please, I really don't give a toss about what sort of relationship you have. But you haven't answered my question. What do you plan to do about my hacking into your computer?"
"Lisbeth, I'm not here to blackmail you. I'm here to ask you to help me do some research. You can say yes or no. If you say no, fine. I'll find someone else. And you'll never hear from me again."
Chapter 19. Thursday, June 19th, to Sunday, June 29th.
While he waited for word on whether Wanger was going to pull through or not, Blomqvist spent the days going over his materials. He kept in close touch with Frodo. On Thursday evening, Frodo brought him the news that the immediate crisis seemed to be over. "I was able to talk to him for a while today. He wants to see you as soon as possible." So it was that around 1 on the afternoon of Midsummer Eve, Blomqvist drove to Hedestad Hospital and went in search of the ward. He encountered an angry Birger Wanger who blocked his way. Henrik could not possibly receive visitors, he said. "That's odd," Blomqvist said. "Henrik sent word saying that he expressly wanted to see me today." "You're not a member of the family. You have no business here." "You're right. I'm not a member of the family. But I'm working for Henrik Wanger, and I take orders only from him." This might have led to a heated exchange if Frodo had not at that moment come out of Wanger's room. "Oh, there you are. Henrik has been asking after you." Frodo held open the door, and Blomqvist walked past Birger into the room. Wanger looked to have aged 10 years. He was lying with his eyes half closed, an oxygen tube in his nose, and his hair more dishevelled than ever. A nurse stopped Blomqvist, putting a hand firmly on his arm.
"2 minutes, no more, and don't upset him."
Blomqvist sat on a visitor's chair so that he could see Wanger's face. He felt a tenderness that astonished him, and he stretched out his hand to gently squeeze the old man's hand.
"Any news?"
The voice was weak. Blomqvist nodded. "I'll give you a report as soon as you're better. I haven't solved the mystery yet, but I've found more new stuff and I'm following up a number of leads. In a week, perhaps two, I'll be able to tell the results." The most Wanger could manage was to blink, indicating that he understood. "I have to be away for a few days." Henrik raised his eyebrows. "I'm not jumping ship. I have some research to do. I've reached an agreement with Dirk that I should report to him. Is that okay with you?"
"Dirk is my man in all matters."
Blomqvist squeezed Wanger's hand again.
"Mikhail, if I don't, I want you to finish the job."
"I will finish the job."
"Dirk has full..."
"Henrik, I want you to get better. I'd be furious with you if you went and died after I've made such progress."
2 minutes, the nurse said.
"Next time we'll have a long talk." Birger Wanger was waiting for him when he came out. He stopped him by laying a hand on his shoulder.
"I don't want you bothering Henrik any more. He's very ill, and he's not supposed to be upset or disturbed."
"I understand your concern, and I sympathize, and I'm not going to upset him. Everyone knows that Henrik hired you to poke around in his little hobby, Harriet.
Dirk said that Henrik became very upset after a conversation you had with him before he had the heart attack. He even said that you thought you had caused the attack."
"I don't think so any more. Henrik had severe blockages in his arteries. He could have had a heart attack just by having a pee. I'm sure you know that by now."
"I want full disclosure into this lunacy. This is my family you're mucking around in."
"I told you. I work for Henrik, not for the family." Birger Wanger was apparently not used to having anyone stand up to him. For a moment he stared at Blomqvist with an expression that was presumably meant to instill respect, but which made him look more like an inflated moose. Birger turned and went into Wanger's room. Blomqvist restrained the urge to laugh. This was no place for laughter, in the corridor outside Wanger's sickbed, which might also turn out to be his deathbed. But he thought of a verse from Lennart Helan's rhyming alphabet. It was the letter M. "And all alone the moose he stood, laughing in a shot-up wood." In the hospital lobby he ran into Cecilia Wanger. He had tried calling her mobile a dozen times since she came back from her interrupted holiday, but she had never answered or returned his calls. And she was never home at her place on Hedeby Island whenever he walked past and knocked on the door.
"Hi, Cecilia," he said. "I'm so sorry about all this with Henrik."
"Thanks,"
she said. "We need to talk."
"I'm sorry that I've shut you out like this. I can understand that you must be cross, but I'm not having an easy time of it these days."
Mikhail put his hand on her arm and smiled at her.
"Wait, you've got it wrong, Cecilia. I'm not cross at all. I'm still hoping that we can be friends. Can we have a cup of coffee?"
He nodded in the direction of the hospital cafeteria. Cecilia Wanger hesitated.
"Not today. I need to go and see Henrik."
"Okay, but I still need to talk to you. It's purely professional."
"What does that mean?"
she was suddenly alert. "Do you remember the first time we met, when you came to the cottage in January? I said that we were talking off the record, and that if I needed to ask you any real questions, I would tell you. It has to do with Harriet." Cecilia Wanger's face was suddenly flushed with anger.
"You really are the fucking pits!"
"Cecilia, I found some things that I really do have to talk to you about." She took a step away from him.
"Don't you realize that this bloody hunt for that cursed Harriet is just occupational therapy for Henrik? Don't you see that he might be up there dying, and the very last thing he needs is to get upset again and be filled with false hopes and..."
"It may be a hobby for Henrik, but there is now more material to go on than anyone has had to work with in a very long time. There are questions that do now need to be answered."
"If Henrik dies, that investigation is going to be over awfully damn fast. Then you'll be out on your grubby, snivelling, investigative backside," Cecilia said, and she walked away.
Everything was closed. Hedestad was practically deserted, and the inhabitants seemed to have retreated to their midsummer poles at their summer cottages. Blomqvist made for the Stads Hotel terrace, which was actually open, and there he was able to order coffee and a sandwich and read the evening papers. Nothing of importance was happening in the world. He put the paper down and thought about Cecilia Wanger. He had told no one, apart from the Salander girl, that she was the one who had opened the window in Harriet's room. He was afraid that it would make her a suspect, and the last thing he wanted to do was hurt her. But the question was going to have to be asked, sooner or later. He sat on the terrace for an hour before he decided to set the whole problem aside and devote Midsummer Eve to something other than the Wanger family. His mobile was silent. Berger was away amusing herself somewhere with her husband, and he had no one to talk to. He went back to Hedeby Island at around 4 in the afternoon and made another decision, to stop smoking. He'd been working out regularly ever since he did his military service, both at the gym and by running along Söder Mellerstrand, but had fallen out of the habit when the problems with Wennerström began. It was Ruloka prison that he had started pumping iron again, mostly as therapy. But since his release he had taken almost no exercise. It was time to start again. He put on his tracksuit and set off at a lazy pace along the road to Gottfried's cabin, turned off towards the fortress, and took a rougher course cross-country. He had done no orienteering since he was in the military, but he had always thought it was more fun to run through a wooded terrain than on a flat track. He followed the fence around Ustergården back to the village. He was aching all over and out of breath by the time he took the last steps up to the guest house. At 6 he took a shower. He boiled some potatoes and had open sandwiches of pickled herring in mustard sauce with chives and egg on a rickety table outside the cottage facing the bridge. He poured himself a shot of aquavit and drank a toast to himself. After that he opened a crime novel by Val McDermid entitled The Mermaid's Singing. At around 7 Frodo drove up and sat heavily in the chair across from him. Blomqvist poured himself a shot of Skåne aquavit.
"You stirred up some rather lively emotions today," Frodo said.
"I could see that. Birger is a conceited fool.
I know that.
But Cecilia is not a conceited fool, and she's furious."
Mikael nodded.
"She has instructed me to see that you stop poking around in the family's affairs."
"I see.
And what did you say to her?"
Frodo looked at his glass of Skåne and downed the liquor in one gulp.
"My response was that Henrik has given me clear instructions about what he wants you to do. As long as he doesn't change those instructions, you will continue to be employed under the terms of your contract. I expect you to do your best to fulfill your part of the contract."
Blomqvist looked up at the sky, where rain clouds had begun to gather.
"Looks like a storm is brewing," Frodo said. "If the winds get too strong, I'll have to back you up."
"Thank you."
They sat in silence for a while.
"Could I have another drink?"
Only minutes after Frodo had gone home, Martin Wanger drove up and parked his car by the road in front of the cottage. He came over and said hello. Mikael wished him a happy midsummer and asked if he'd like a drink.
"No, it's better if I don't. I'm just here to change my clothes, and then I'm going to drive back to town to spend the evening with Eva."
Blomqvist waited.
I've talked to Cecilia. She's a little traumatized just now. She and Henrik have always been close. I hope you'll forgive her if she says anything unpleasant.
I'm very fond of Cecilia.
I know that. But she can be difficult. I just want you to know that she's very much against your going on digging into our past.
Blomqvist sighed. Everyone in Hedestad seemed to know why Vanger had hired him.
What's your feeling?
This thing with Harriet has been Henrik's obsession for decades. I don't know. Harriet was my sister, but somehow it feels all so far away. Dirk says that you have a contract that only Henrik can break, and I'm afraid that in his present condition it would do more harm than good.
So you want me to continue?
Have you made any progress?
I'm sorry, Martin, but it would be a breach of that contract if I told you anything without Henrik's permission.
I understand.
Suddenly he smiled.
Henrik is a bit of a conspiracy fanatic, but above all, I don't want you to get his hopes up unnecessarily.
I won't do that.
Good. By the way, to change the subject, we now have another contract to consider as well. Given that Henrik is ill and can't in the short term fulfil his obligations on the Millennium Board, it's my responsibility to take his place.
Mikael waited.
I suppose we should have a board meeting to look at the situation.
Well, that's a good idea. But as far as I know, it's been decided that the next board meeting won't be held until August.
I know that, but maybe we should hold it earlier.
Blomqvist smiled politely.
You're really talking to the wrong person. At the moment, I'm not on the board. I left in December.
You should get in touch with Erika Berger. She knows that Henrik has been taken ill.
Martin Vanger had not expected this response.
You're right, of course. I'll talk to her.
He patted Blomqvist on the shoulder to say goodbye and was gone. Nothing concrete had been said, but the threat hung in the air. Martin Vanger had set Millennium on the balance tray. After a moment, Blomqvist poured himself another drink and picked up his Val McDermott. The mottled brown cat came to say hello and rubbed on his leg. He lifted her up and scratched behind her ears.
"The two of us are having a very boring Midsummer Eve, aren't we?" he said.
When it started to rain, he went inside and went to bed. The cat preferred to stay outdoors. Salander got out her Kawasaki on Midsummer Eve and spent the day giving it a good overhaul. A lightweight 125cc might not be the toughest bike in the world, but it was hers, and she could handle it. She had restored it one nut at a time, and she had souped it up just a bit over the legal limit. In the afternoon she put on her helmet and leather suit and drove to Eppelviken nursing home, where she spent the evening in the park with her mother. She felt a pang of concern and guilt. Her mother seemed more remote than ever before. During 3 hours they exchanged only a few words, and when they did speak, her mother did not seem to know who she was talking to. Blomqvist wasted several days trying to identify the car with the AC plates. After a lot of trouble, and finally by consulting a retired mechanic in Hedestad, he came to the conclusion that the car was a Ford Anglia, a model that he had never heard of before. Then he contacted a clerk at the motor vehicle department and inquired about the possibility of getting a list of all the Ford Anglias in 1966 that had a license plate beginning AC3. He was eventually told that such an archaeological excavation in the records presumably could be done, but that it would take time, and it was beyond the boundaries of what could be considered public information. Not until several days after Midsummer did Blomqvist get into his borrowed Volvo and drive north on the E4. He drove at a leisurely pace. Just short of the Hernesand Bridge, he stopped to have coffee at the Vesterlund pastry shop. The next stop was Umeå, where he pulled into an inn and had the daily special. He bought a road atlas and continued on to Skellefteå, where he turned towards Norsjö. He arrived around 6 in the evening and took a room in the Hotel Norsjö. He began his search early the next morning. The Norsjö carpentry shop was not in the telephone book. The Polar Hotel desk clerk, a girl in her 20s, had never heard of the business.
"Who should I ask?"
The clerk looked puzzled for a few seconds until her face lit up and she said that she would call her father. 2 minutes later she came back and explained that the Norsjö carpentry shop closed in the early 80s. If he needed to talk to someone who knew more about the business, he should go and see a certain Borman, who had been the foreman and who now lived on a street called Solvenden. Norsjö was a small town with one main street, appropriately enough called Storgaten, that ran through the whole community. It was lined with shops with residential side streets off it. At the east end there was a small industrial area and a stable. At the western end stood an uncommonly beautiful wooden church. Blomqvist noted that the village also had a missionary church and a Pentecostal church. A poster on a bulletin board at the bus station advertised a hunting museum and a skiing museum. A leftover flyer announced that Veronica would sing at the fairgrounds at midsummer. He could walk from one end of the village to the other in less than 20 minutes. The street called Solvenden consisted of single-family homes and was about 5 minutes from the hotel. There was no answer when Blomqvist rang the bell. It was 9:30, and he assumed that Boerman had left for work or, if he was retired, was out on an errand. His next stop was the hardware store on Storgaten. He reasoned that anyone living in Norsjö would sooner or later pay a visit to the hardware store. There were two sales clerks in the shop. Blomqvist chose the older one, maybe 50 or so. "Hi. I'm looking for a couple who probably lived in Norsjö in the 60s. The man might have worked for the Norsjö carpentry shop. I don't know their name, but I have two pictures that were taken in 1966. The clerk studied the photographs for a long time, but finally shook his head, saying he could not recognize either the man or the woman. At lunchtime he had a burger at a hot dog stand near the bus station. He had given up on the shops and had made his way through the municipal office, the library, and the pharmacy. The police station was empty, and he had started approaching older people at random. Early in the afternoon he asked two young women. They did not recognize the couple in the photographs, but they did have a good idea.
"If the pictures were taken in 1966, the people would have to be in their 60s today. Why don't you go over to the retirement home on Solbacka and ask there?"
Blomqvist introduced himself to a woman at the front desk of the retirement home, explaining what he wanted to know. She glared at him suspiciously, but finally allowed herself to be persuaded. She led him to the day room, where he spent half an hour showing the pictures to a group of elderly people. They were very helpful, but none of them could identify the couple. At 5 he went back to Solvenden and knocked on Boerman's door. This time he had better luck. The Boermans, both the man and the wife, were retired, and they had been out all day. They invited Blomqvist into their kitchen, where his wife promptly made coffee while Mikhail explained his errand. As with all his other attempts that day, he again drew a blank. Boerman scratched his head, lit a pipe, and then concluded after a moment that he did not recognize the couple in the photographs. The Boermans spoke in a distinct Norsjö dialect to each other, and Blomqvist occasionally had difficulty understanding what they were saying. The wife meant curly hair when she remarked that the woman in the picture had knövelhaire.
"But you're right that it's a sticker from the carpentry shop," her husband said. "That was clever of you to recognize it. But the problem was that we handed out those stickers left and right, to contractors, people who bought or delivered timber, joiners, machinists, all sorts."
"It's turning out to be harder to find this couple than I thought."
"Why do you want to find them?"
Blomqvist had decided to tell the truth, if anyone asked him. Any attempt to make up a story about the couple in the pictures would just sound false and create confusion.
"It's a long story. I'm investigating a crime that occurred in Hedestad in 1966, and I think there's a possibility, although a very small one, that the people in the photographs might have seen what happened. They are not in any way under suspicion, and I don't think they're even aware that they might have information that could solve the crime."
"A crime? What kind of crime?"
"I'm sorry, but I can't tell you any more than that. I know it sounds bizarre that someone would come here almost 40 years later trying to find this couple, but the crime is still unsolved, and it's only lately that new facts have come to light."
"I see. Yes, this is certainly an unusual assignment that you're on."
"How many people worked at the carpentry shop?"
"The normal workforce was 40 or so. I worked there from the age of 17 in the mid-50s until the shop closed. Then I became a contractor."
Boerman thought for a moment.
"This much I can tell you. The guy in your pictures never worked there. He might have been a contractor, but I think I'd recognize him if he was. But there is one other possibility. Maybe his father or some other relative worked at the shop, and that's not his car."
Mikhail nodded.
"I realize there are lots of possibilities. Can you suggest anyone I could talk to?"
"Yes," said Boerman, nodding. "Come by tomorrow morning and we'll go and have a talk with some of the old guys."
Salander was facing a methodology problem of some significance. She was an expert at digging up information on just about anybody, but her starting point had always been a name and a social security number for a living person.